It's the Steve Fast Show on WJBC. This week, Tuesday, April 14th, marks the 150th anniversary of the assassination of Abraham Lincoln. Everyone knows that John Wilkes Booth shot Lincoln, but few remember the name of the man who sent Booth to his end. In his book, The Madman and the Assassin, Scott Martell tells the story of the man who shot Booth, Union Sergeant Boston Corbett, an unlikely hero, and afterward, a somewhat off-kilter celebrity. And we welcome Scott Martell to the show. Scott, thanks for being with us today.
Thanks for having me on, Steve. I appreciate it.
So for those that aren't up on history, what were the circumstances under which John Wilkes Booth was shot?
Well, he'd been on the lam with a fellow conspirator for 10 or 12 days and had holed up at a tobacco farm in Northern Virginia. And the New York Cavalry, the 16th Cavalry Unit, in which Boston Corbett was a member, was one of, I don't know how many different units that were dispatched to try to track him down. And just so happenstance, they managed to find him at this tobacco farm. And when Booth and his comrade, David Harold, heard the cavalry coming, they tried to escape from the tobacco barn, found themselves locked in, and then a standoff ensued that lasted for several hours.
Boston Corbett was the one that took that shot. Was there any particular reason he was able to get the best bead on Booth?
Well, it was again, purely by happenstance. The cavalry had surrounded the barn, the tobacco barn. And if you've ever seen an old tobacco barn, but the wall boards don't go right tight together. There's air, space between them for air to circulate. So they were all around, surrounding the barn, watching Booth and Harold inside. They finally talked Harold into coming out. Then Booth was in there alone. One of the leaders of the search party went to the back of the tobacco barn, lit a bunch of brush on fire in the back against the back wall. So the tobacco barn started burning. And Booth, at that point, according to Corbett later, raised his rifle as though he was going to shoot through the front door where some of the soldiers were standing. So Corbett raised his gun and shot Booth.
Now, was Corbett the only one who could see Booth at the time?
I don't know. I'd be surprised if he was the only one because the fire was burning inside the tobacco barn at that point. So anybody who was close enough to one of these cracks in the wall should have been able to see him. But he was at the angle he could see Booth raising the rifle.
So Boston Corbett was one of the first volunteers to join the Union effort. What motivated him to want to be a part of the war?
Two different motivations. By accounts by his friends at the time, he was very opposed to slavery, very pro-abolitionist, deeply held religious man, deeply held Christian views. And a lot of that sentiment coursed through the abolition movement. So he had that moral desire to go and fight. He also apparently was paid by his boss to go. His boss was a member of Corbett signed up four different times over the course of the year. The first time he signed up, it was in the 12th New York State Militia. And his boss, who ran a fur-heading operation in Manhattan, was a member of that militia. When the call-up came, he didn't feel as though he could go for work reasons. He wasn't feeling too well. In that era, if you were a member of a militia and you were called up, you could hire somebody to go in your place. And apparently that's what this guy named Brown did. He paid Corbett to take his place.
So when he was serving, Boston Corbett was taken prisoner, and he ended up serving time in the Andersonville prison camp, which was one of the most notorious camps during the Civil War.
Yeah, it was a horrific place. He had been caught by Mosby's Rangers, which is one of the marauding Confederate units in Northern Virginia, and was held for about 5 months, most of it in that Andersonville prison, which, in calling it a prison, overstates it. It was a fairly large open-air stockade, which held at some point more than 30,000 Union soldiers. Very few of them had any sort of shelter. It was, you know, sort of make little lean-tos, that kind of thing. There was a creek that coursed through the middle of the place. The filth was just incredible. More people were carried out of there dead than finally left on their own volition. But Corbett Minister survived through all that, propelled, I think, by his faith. He told a friend of his in the camp that God had spoken to him and told him that he would survive.
We're talking with Scott Martell. He is the author of The Madman and the Assassin. It tells the story of the man who shot John Wilkes Booth, Union soldier at Boston Corbett. So, Scott, you mentioned his faith. He was very religious. In fact, he suggested going back to his shot through those slats in the tobacco barn. He suggested that divine guidance was involved in shooting Booth. What did he say?
Well, that's a little murky. There was nothing that was reported at the time by his fellow soldiers and commanders about him saying divine guidance. That sort of came up in the narrative after the fact. In fact, shortly after he shot Booth, his commander told him to go forage for some breakfast. for the rest of the unit. And he went off on his horse to do that. But before he got very far, he stopped under a tree to pray and to ask God if he had indeed done the right thing. So if he really did feel that it was a divine intervention, he wouldn't have stopped to make that prayer.
One of the things that's kind of remarkable is that Lincoln and Booth were both basically shot in about the same location. They both suffered very similar fatal wounds.
Yeah, they were shot around the same spot on the head, although the bullet trajectory was different. President Lincoln, the bullet went into the skull, into the brain. With Booth, it just sort of crashed through the top of the spinal column, rendering him essentially paralyzed. There's a much quoted interplay while he was lying on the ground, slowly dying, where he asked some of the soldiers who were around him to lift his hands up before his eyes so he could see them. And he muttered, useless, useless, because he's looking at his own hands.
Was there any consensus on if there was or was not an order to try to take Booth alive when they approached him and cornered him in the barn?
Yeah, there were a lot of speculations and rumors that arose after the incident, but I found nothing in the record that said that they were to take him alive. I think it was sort of understood that they all preferred to take him alive. You know, they hadn't been sent out to kill him. They'd been sent out to capture him. And Corbett himself said that when he took aim at Booth, he was aiming for his shoulder, trying to disable him. But as he was squeezing the trigger, either the gun moved or Booth had leaned forward a little bit. And so the bullet went a few inches off the mark Corbett was intending, which is unusual. Corbett was by all accounts, an excellent marksman. But in any case, he wasn't trying to kill him. He was just trying to stop him from firing the rifle.
Booth's words, as he lay there wounded in the barn, aren't the only kind of dramatic and strange things that happened surrounding his shooting. There are a lot of weird details surrounding Booth's capture and death. How was his body disposed of?
Well, initially, it was buried in a hidden spot. The Union soldiers, Union leadership, were afraid that he would be held up as some sort of martyr to the cause of the South. So they buried him without fanfare or marker, I believe, on the grounds of a military-related property. But a while later, after the passions settled down, the family was allowed to reclaim the body, and he's buried, I believe, somewhere in Maryland now.
We're talking with Scott Martell. He is the author of The Madman and the Assassin, The Strange Life of Boston, Corbett, the Man Who Killed John Wilkes Booth. A lot of rumors arose about Corbett after it became known that he was the one who shot Booth, and he became a celebrity in the media. He was certainly an unusual man before this incident, but what sort of things arose that people would say about him?
Well, the main one was that he never shot Booth, that either Booth hadn't been shot or that somebody else had been shot and, you know, the body was charted out as being Booth. Also, that someone else pulled the trigger. You know, it's kind of like, you know, modern-day conspiracy theories. There are all sorts of conspiracy theories that were floating around, some of which continue to today. I mean, supposedly Booth showed up and lived under another name, another identity in Enid, Oklahoma for years and died well after the end of the Civil War. That's all been debunked by, you know, serious and knowledgeable historians. It's pretty clear that, you know, it was Booth who was in the tobacco barn that day, and it was Corbett who killed him.
Corbett exhibited a lot of paranoid behavior, and this might be somewhat justified after he shot Booth because he experienced death threats. This was a very divided country, and in some people's eyes, they did see Booth as a martyr, and Corbett received death threats.
Yeah, that's all according to friends of his. I didn't find any of the letters in the archives, but it was pretty clear from conversations that were going on at the time that, you know, Corbett was receiving death threats, and there were newspapers that were still solidly with the Confederacy, and they were writing disparaging articles about him and about his role and everything. So it was a pretty hard time for him.
How did Boston Corbett react to all of that attention?
Yeah, it varied. Sometimes there were stories of him, you know, pulling a gun on people who were questioning his truthfulness. He was an incredibly honest man. Early in his life, in his adult life, he had a religious epiphany and joined in with a splinter version of Methodism and believed, according to a friend of his, that he could strive to live every minute, every hour of every day like Christ would. And through that, he'll lead a very Christ-like existence, Christ-like life. So he had that faith kind of propelling him through all this stuff. And that sort of gave him a little bit of an even keel. It's, I think, what got him through Andersonville. It's what got him through this huge celebrity and all the negativity that was pouring down on him. But he's also a human and psychologically imbalanced in some ways. So sometimes it would flare up.
Well, you mentioned his psychological imbalance. He did suffer a lot of loss earlier in his life. it seems like that really tipped him over the edge. This is years before he shot Booth, but he had even mutilated himself after suffering some personal loss.
Yeah, he had married fairly young, and his wife died shortly, like within a year, a couple of years, I guess, after they got married. And the story was, I didn't find very accurate depictions of this, but the legend around the time was that he just sort of fell into a whiskey barrel and couldn't crawl his way out. Then one day he was taken in by some teetotaling evangelist who cleaned him up, dried him out. And that sort of began his process of religious epiphany. And then he became a street preacher. They referred to him as the Glory to God man because he'd go to prayer meetings, and whenever a prayer struck a chord that he responded with, he just had kind of a squeaky voice. And he just sort of belt out, Glory to God, Glory to God. Even some of his fellow very observant Christians were kind of sick of him because he was just so over the top. And I don't know if you'd call that behavior, psychologically imbalanced, but he was definitely, marching to his own drummer. And compounding things is he made his living as a finisher of silk hats. And part of that process, which I write about in The Madman and the Assassin, part of that process is mixing mercury in with a liquid and using that to soften and shape the felt top of the hat. And that becomes aerated. And these guys were all inhaling this stuff back before anybody realized what mercury could do to the brain. And I'm sure you've heard the expression, mad as a hatter. That came because all these guys who were involved in the hat-making industry became psychologically imbalanced, in retrospect, because of the exposure to mercury. With Corbett, it's unclear how much that affected his psychology. He didn't really get progressively worse until years and years after he'd been exposed to the mercury. I'm not a doctor, and I don't even begin to try to diagnose what was going on with him in terms of mental illness and physical illness. But he was a physical wreck by the 1870s, 1880s.
After he left the Army, he went back to religion and became a preacher for a while. But eventually, he was institutionalized. What sort of behavior led him to the asylum?
Well, he had started his own church. He got a permission from a recognition from the Methodist Church in Connecticut first, and then New Jersey to be a preacher. So he ran his own little storefront-style church in Camden, New Jersey. Recession came along. He was having trouble getting and holding a job as a hat finisher. When you run a small storefront church, you aren't getting money from that. We began scrambling around looking for a way to make a living. The short version is he never quite caught on. A friend of his told him about an unclaimed 80-acre homestead in sort of east central Kansas, Cloud County, Kansas. So we went out there and staked a claim to that and wound up moving out there, hoping at that point to become a farmer, which is something he had never done. And there was a reason why that 80 acres was unclaimed. It wasn't particularly fertile, a lot of rocks, some hills. So he went out there and it was sort of half starving to death. He was a popular figure among the Union veterans, a regular speaker at the Grand Army of the Republic reunions and that kind of thing. So as he got into worse and worse political shape, friends sort of went to bat for him, and one of them was a member of the Kansas State Legislature. And he got Corbett a position as, I think it was third assistant, third deputy doorkeeper, which is sort of a glorified doorman in the place, keeping the order in the gallery of the legislature. That also gave him the ability to carry his gun and his knife. So he was in the capital of Topeka one day, and heard some janitors making a joke and laughing, and delusionally thought they were laughing about him and joke about him. Pulled his gun out and emptied out that part of the Capitol. Hours later, an hours-long standoff, some police officers, marshals finally snuck up on him and dropped on him. The next day, he appeared before a judge who declared him insane after listening to his testimony. He had this broad conspiracy theory about secret fraternal organizations that Booth and the Confederates belonged to that were going after him. Some guy back in Cloud County who was after his property. It was all just delusional stuff. So he was sent to the Kansas State Asylum, mental asylum outside of Topeka, and wound up there for about a year before he finally made his escape.
So once he escaped, did he just disappear?
Actually, his escape was kind of funny. It'd make a great scene in a movie. He was out walking the grounds with some of the other asylum patients. And in that era, the managers of the asylums lived on the grounds, and the manager of this particular asylum had a son. So they're out walking around selling flowers and all that. A young guy, like 9 or 10, rode up on a pony, tethered the pony, and went into the building to visit his friend. Corbett saw that happen, slowed down, smells more flowers. The parade of inmates goes by, and he makes a break with the pony, hops on it, and takes off. And he showed up a couple of days later in Neodesha, I probably mispronouncing it, in southeast Kansas, where he had a friend, a fellow Andersonville survivor. And he spent a couple days there. I told the friend, you know, where the pony came from, told him to make sure he got back to his rightful owner, and then boarded a train telling his friends he was taking off for Mexico. And then he disappears from the face of history.
There are a lot of rumors surrounding his disappearance. What are some of the things that people would say?
So there's one main scam artist who arose and tried to tell the world that he was Corbett to collect his property and collect his pension. Another one is that Corbett, there was a huge fire in Minnesota, the Hinckley fire, killed a couple hundred people, if I recall, off the top of my head. Austin Corbett's real name was Thomas Corbett, and there was a guy named Thomas Corbett who died in that fire. And some other logger had said that Thomas Corbett had told him that he was the true Boston Corbett. But that doesn't seem to fit. I mean, I don't put much weight in that for a variety of reasons, not the least of which is Boston Corbett, by that stage of his life, was in no physical condition to work or survive in a logging camp in northern Minnesota. There were little rumors that popped up, you know, that he had been sighted somewhere else. The lawyer who had been appointed his guardian when he was in the insane asylum tracked down all these rumors as they popped up, but was never able to find whatever happened to Corbett.
Do you think that the press at the time had a hard time reckoning with Boston Corbett as a hero in this story? I imagine that there was a great deal of desire for closure to see Booth and, of course, the other people that were charged with conspiring with him, justly and in some cases unjustly, in the killing of the president. This became a serial news event. How do you think the press reckoned with Boston Corbett?
They didn't deal with him in too much depth, actually. There were some stories that cropped up here and there that had some depth. In that era, there wasn't a whole lot of attribution, and some of them were just flat-out wrong. So it's almost like, you know, whatever the rumor that the reporter heard in the street that day wound up in the paper. So there wasn't really an awful lot about him, just that he was, you know, sort of an odd man, his religious fervor, a little bit of his work history. Remember, at the same time that this fallout was happening, there was the trial of the conspirators. Several of them were hanged outside of Washington. There was reconstruction going on, what to do with the South. There was a whole lot of cross-cutting stories, and Corbett was just sort of, you know, one of the odd little echo parts of it.
Scott Martell's book, The Madman and the Assassin, tells the story of Boston Corbett, the man who killed John Wilkes Booth, and he's been joining us here today. Scott, thanks so much for being with us.
Steve, I appreciate the invitation, and I appreciate the interest. Thank you.
We're going to take a break. We'll be back after this. It's the Steve Fast Show on WJBC.